Hi there. Welcome to The Real Film Chronicles. As always, I'm Nathan.
My name is Brian.
And this is episode 16, wherein we talk about Nicolas Cage's latest, Pig.
16 episodes in, we've got another Nicolas Cage movie popping up here. It felt like a very short amount of time ago we were talking about Willy's Wonderland. I think we owe a part of the podcast to Nicolas Cage with how much we've brought him up during these episodes. So really excited that Pig comes out seemingly out of nowhere, for me at least. Like, I don't feel like I heard about this movie until it landed digitally. What was it, last month it came out, maybe? July, I believe. It had a short theatrical run. It's pretty much been up for like a premium digital rental or purchase for a little bit now. Wow, pretty amazing stuff. I guess before we jump into Pig, so there's no spoilers at the moment, of course, you have been going on a bit of a Nicolas Cage experience. You've been collecting some of his films that have been missing out of your movie collection and trying to catch up on some that you missed. Have there been any highlights recently? Are you caged out yet?
Yes, I believe you're referring to the Cage Fest of 2021. Yes, I'm on a mission to collect and watch Nicolas Cage films. Just one of my kind of projects to get me, just helps keep me inspired just watching movies and stuff. So I've been filling in some gaps with some notable absences like Face Off and Con Air, and really like, you know, Nick Cage and prime action 90s action movie kind of fare. So I just literally this past weekend, not this weekend, but the weekend before, sat down and watched Con Air with my 10-year-old son.
Oh, nice.
Man, it was such a blast. It was so much fun. I remember Con Air as being one of my favorite films as a kid. Favorite movies, I guess. I don't know if you want to get into that debate of film or cinema versus not cinema, but Con Air is just such, like, it is like the like epitome of 90s action movie, popcorn, action adventure, just amazing film. It was tons of fun.
I have to revisit that.
Yeah. And then,
like, for me, like the 90s Nick Cage action, 90s.
Well, there's a whole trilogy of, you know, the 90s Nick Cage action movies, right?
Yeah. Well, what is the trilogy here?
Well, you've got Con Air.
Yeah.
And you got Face Off. And then you've got The Rock.
Yeah.
That is the Holy Trinity. The Holy Trinity right there.
I mean, for me, The Rock was probably my favorite film for a couple of years there.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. Loved every second of that. Face Off was incredible. Did The Rock? No, it was literally in chronological order. Was The Rock, Con Air, and Face Off? I think, right?
I think so. I'd have to double check on that, but I'll defer to your expertise.
I'm checking this right now. The Rock 96, Con Air 97, and Face Off 97. Can you imagine a year in which you get both Con Air and Face Off within 12 calendar months of each other?
That's pretty amazing. Like, That's a career highlight for anybody. Like, how many people can, how many actors can top that career highlight?
And then, I mean, we have a sidestep with City of Angels. Absolutely fine. I haven't seen it. And immediately after City of Angels, which was 98, we've got Snake Eyes, Brian De Palma's Snake Eyes in 1998. Again, it was just like, man, this guy is on fire. Like, 8mm in 99 with Scorsese. Insane.
No, that wasn't Scorsese. Sorry. You're thinking about
Next movie in 99 was Bringing Out the Dead.
Yes.
So 8mm and Bringing Out the Dead in 1999. Oh, wow. Wow.
Now, on the flip side, though, I mean, there's been Cage's notoriety in recent years of starring in a lot of what we would consider like direct-to-video fare.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that term is as meaningful in this day and age of streaming. But I picked up a movie called Primal, which not the best, but again, is like, I always love watching Nicolas Cage do his thing, even if it's not in the best kind of movie. And there's another one called Kill Chain I picked up. There's another recent one. There's another one called 211 or 211. I guess 211, because like 211 is like the police call sign for whatever the crime was. I think it was armed robbery. There was a lot of, I think it was armed robbery, because there was a lot of crimes going on in 211 that, but it's like as kind of, I guess low budget or kind of indie as these films are, Yeah. It's always great to see Cage at work, like see this master at work. And it's also kind of neat to see, just like with Pig, and I think 211 was another great example of like these first time directors or these people kind of just breaking into the industry. And Nick Cage is like, I don't know what he's like in real life, but it seems like he's got this no ego kind of approach where he's like, this young untested person in the industry has this really cool idea that I think is like, it's pretty neat. I'm going to go and invest my time and money, or not my money, but invest my time and invest my resources and lend my talent to this kind of potential up and comer. Right. So it's kind of a neat little trade-off for people. You know, obviously there's that kind of meme of like Cage just doing low budget direct to video stuff. But it's like, on the flip side though, it's like all of a sudden Cage is bringing his spotlight to these filmmakers who might not otherwise get that exposure. And that's kind of a neat thing for him to be essentially kind of mentoring or kind of passing that torch or like spreading, you know, like the whole thing about like a rising ship, you know, a rising tide raises all ships kind of thing. Right.
Yeah. No, I think that's a really valid point. Like that's really interesting because he seems to kind of stepped aside from the normal Hollywood, you know, glamour lifestyle. And it's just like, this guy is an actor. He clearly loves acting and he's going to be in a bunch of different projects. And the other talent around, like you say, these first time directors or people breaking into the industry, he gets a lot of exposure to those guys and will take chances. He's not worried about, you know, not being able to do a movie that might have a big budget or a bigger director. Like he just wants to be in a bunch of different films.
Yeah.
And I'm like, just sort of looking at some of his films of the past 10 years, you know, there's not a lot of sequels here. There's a huge array of genres. Like this guy is working a lot. And it kind of reminds me, I was listening to a podcast with Matt Damon being interviewed. And he said at the end of the day, he just loves to act. And Matt Damon is kind of known for being in a lot of small cameos in different roles. And he's like, listen, if you contact me and you have an interesting project and it literally takes 1 or 2 days of filming, I'm probably going to fly out to your part of the country and do 1 or 2 days of filming to go be in your cameo because it's a chance for him to act a little more. And he gets to do that sort of thing in between some of the bigger projects that he does. And Nick Cage, I mean, he gives him, I think he said this before, he gives himself everything he has into these roles. And I think he brought it up in the Willy's Wonderland episode a few episodes ago, where this guy is like a Ferrari. Right. Like he's, and you have to know how to handle this guy. Like you will get amazing performance out of him, but some of these directors may not get that out of him. Right. You have to know how to handle the Ferrari, but he's willing to work with you to give you whatever you want on screen. So you get some hits and you get some misses, obviously, but in exploring some of these lesser known films, and I mean, some of these movies you mentioned are only like a year or two old at this point. Like, what kind of ratings are you giving these? Are these good movies people should be checking out?
Like, I think Primal, I had it at maybe 2 stars. 211 was probably 2, maybe 2.5. I think Kill Chain, probably 2.5. So, these are not game-changing films, and they're not, like, maybe groundbreaking, genre-defining films. But I think that these are kind of films that are worth checking out, right? It's interesting to go see what these other filmmakers are doing outside of the mainstream a little bit and to see is like, oh, could this be the next Martin Scorsese? It's probably not going to be, right? Odds are it's not. But like, you know, in order to allow the next Francis Ford Coppola or the next Martin Scorsese or the next Spielberg to kind of, you know, kind of rise to the top, you know, you have to give people chances. You have to create those opportunities for people with those talents and with those abilities and with those gifts to be able to rise to the surface. And I think that part of that process is you have to go out and you have to try different things, even if those projects are gonna maybe end up, you know, failing, quote unquote, financially, or end up in like in the bottom of a bargain bin. You know what? Those are you know, every failure is another step on the road to success or progress, right? So people look at it as like, oh, this is a failure, this is a terrible movie. It's like, on the one hand, yeah, it's not a masterpiece. A lot of these Nick Cage movies he's in, they're not masterpieces. They're not going to change anybody's world or redefine cinema. But they're important steps. They're giving people chances to grow. They're giving the next, you know, the next Alfred Hitchcock or whatever, the chance to rise to the surface here, right?
Yeah, and landing such a well-known actor is going to put that spotlight on, which is fantastic for really the entire industry, like the people who are making the movie, the crew. I would imagine that more funding comes to these people on these projects when a big name is attached to it. It's like, again, like you said, it's not going to blow the world apart, but these are movies, and movies are being made all the time. And these ones get to stand above the rest. I'm just looking at Kill Chain, which you mentioned watching. The director, Ken Sanzel, he's done 3 other films over the years. In his bio, it says he is a former New York City cop, which would sort of be an interesting perspective on a movie like that about, like you said, it's about crime and whatnot, right?
Yeah. But it's really neat. So like part of me is like, I'm a fan of Nick Cage. So like, I made it like a project to go out and start collecting all the movies he's been in, you know, all the highs and all the lows, you know, like you're going to get your 211s and your primals, but you're also going to get like your Joes and your Mandys in there too. Right.
Yeah. So do you know how many, like, you have a checklist? Like, I picture like collecting cards back in the day. That one of them would come with like a little checklist. You'd want to write on the card, but you don't really want to write on the card to ruin the collectability of it. But how many movies are in this checklist of Nick Cage? Do you have any idea?
So actually, part of my process is putting together this checklist. So essentially what I'm doing is, I know it seems kind of, you know, maybe in a post-consumer world here, but I'm using my Amazon... I put together an Amazon wish list essentially to help me just keep track of, you know, what movies I'm still looking for and what's available out there. Essentially kind of going through IMDb and essentially transferring the IMDb list over to my wish list. I'm kind of going chronologically and putting them in there. So I'm only up into, I think I got into the 90s and I have to go back in and do all the 2000s and 2010s and put that in the list and then go through and start, you know, kind of checking stuff off to see exactly what I have. But I was kind of just buying stuff at random at this point when I see a Nick Cage movie come up at a decent price, like Season of the Witch I picked up recently, just happened to come down on Amazon, or like, you know, Kill Chain and 211. I just happened to see them at, like, I was at Shoppers Drug Mart and they were in their little movie section. And I just like, yeah, that's an instant buy. They're like $5-$10. It's like done.
No, it's fantastic. Do you know how many you have right now, Nicolas Cage movies in your collection?
I don't. I have to go through and catalog them. I was having the big fun is like watching the movies, and then it's like the side project is like cataloging and all the data management stuff, which is like, but yeah, I'm going to go through and start doing an official run the official numbers on my Cage Fest here, and I guess we got to get organized. The organizers of this event are really kind of letting the ball drop here a little bit. So I got to,
I mean, I love that aspect of this movie hobby. It is just taking on projects like that. And I think this is a pretty good one because he's done so many films over the past, you know, 30 years. But you get to see a lot of stuff that you would normally skip over. Like these movies I've literally never heard of, unless you're really paying attention, you're never going to go out and watch Primal. And here it is. You get to experience some different cinema from that, like a positive perspective, right? It's just like you're supporting this actor. You're supporting all these other creators.
And it's kind of neat because like Nicolas Cage really came into my consciousness. If you go to like, I think if there's a subreddit called like One True Savior, I think, where it talks about Nicolas Cage, is like, it's like almost a parody. It was like Nicolas Cage as a god or whatever. But he, I became aware of him like in the 90s in the action movies. And then I watched a little movie called Moonstruck. My mom actually showed me that one. She was big into movies and showed me movies. And it was like, Moonstruck was never the kind of movie I would watch. I would have watched on my own back then.
Yeah.
But it was really, really good. But if you look at his early career, there are so many movies that he did that I had no idea. Like I thought I had an idea of like a couple movies that he did when he first broke into the scene. Mm-hmm. And I went back and was like, there's dozens of movies in his back catalog. In the, you know, 70s, 80s and 90s that, you know, like I had no idea that it was it was that deep back then. I thought he really picked up the pace in putting out movies or starring in movies in recent years, but it's been pretty steady his whole career. Like his output from the beginning, like you said, this is a guy who he loves to act. He loves to be on screen. He found something he's passionate about and he's thrown himself at it like full force his entire life.
Yeah. So basically like the recent output of movies is not really any different than it was back in the 90s when he was just doing a lot of projects. I think maybe those 90s projects were bigger, but as we just proved, like we had The Rock, Con Air, Face Off, City of Angels, Snake Eyes, all within like 2 years of each other. It's like, that's a lot of content to be putting out where I think a lot of actors probably only do like one big movie a year or something, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's not a pace that a lot of people can keep up. I mean, there's like, you got Nicolas Cage and you've got people like Samuel L. Jackson, who really, yeah, you know, like not that's the kind of pace that not everybody can or is willing to or has to keep up, right? I mean, I think Samuel L. Jackson has talked specifically about he loves being in movies as well, but also in terms of, I think he's battling like addiction issues, I think alcoholism specifically. And I think he's talked about how, I don't want to be putting words into his mouth. I think I remember reading this about Samuel L. Jackson talking about how, you know, being in movies and accepting these roles just keeps him busy and it keeps his mind, it helps him kind of manage those addiction issues. So there's that aspect of it too, but also like he just loves to act. Like Ben Kingsley's another dude who, you know, he's an award-winning Academy award-winning actor who'll just like show up in these random low budgets, direct to video kind of little movies that are so far removed from the mainstream. It's like, what is he even doing? What's he thinking? What is Gandhi thinking? But it's like, no, he loves to act. And if people reach out to him and have a job for him, it's like, make a few bucks, go out to do what I love. I was like, it's kind of neat. So it's for love of the craft, right?
Yeah, it's fantastic. There's a nice positive passion that you can approach these movies from, which is really nice.
And I think that passion shines through in performances. You can tell the people who are really kind of dedicated to, you know, giving it 100%. And Nicolas Cage is one of those actors. I think I was reading up just recently about Nick Cage, and I don't want to misquote Ethan Hawke here, but I think it was Ethan Hawke.
Another podcast favorite.
Yeah, another podcast favorite. Again, Ethan Hawke, we will cast, if we make a movie, we'll cast you in it for sure, 100%. We will not cut
with Nicolas Cage, the two of them together.
Oh my God, stop it. But I think he was saying like, it was since Marlon Brando that Nicolas Cage is really the only actor who's done anything interesting to kind of progress the art of acting in any kind of real meaningful way. Whether or not you agree with that, or whether or not Ethan Hawke actually said that, or whether it was just like some made up stuff or third hand recollection by somebody on the internet is another thing entirely. But I mean, you look at even episodes of Community dedicated to, you know, is Nicolas Cage a good bad actor or a bad good actor? And it's like, I don't think you can argue that Nicolas Cage hasn't in some way, especially for movie fans, he's captured our imaginations in some way, and he forces us every time we watch him. There's something about his performance that kind of forces us to evaluate what acting is and people's approach to acting and an approach to filmmaking and approach to storytelling, right? And it's like, I think that in itself is valuable. Even if you're not a huge fan of Nicolas Cage, when you watch his performance, whether you love him or hate him, he's like, what he's doing on screen is making you think about, you know, deeper issues of like, how do we tell a story and how do actors, you know, acting fit into that storytelling process and you know, what can they do to advance that, you know, those narrative aspects. And I think that that's really interesting with Nick Cage. I'm always kind of have that in the back of my mind when watching his performances, right?
What a performance Nick Cage gives in this movie. Pig.
Yeah.
I don't know if you have anything else to say about Nick Cage's career before we jump into Pig here. I figured maybe
hours
we
worth.
Could, hours worth, right? I mean, this, we will be revisiting Nick Cage as a podcast topic numerous times throughout. I would imagine.
If there were credits for our podcast, I think Nick Cage would be in the credits every time.
yeah, and we're gonna have to get some updates every so often on your Nick Cage viewing. Like on Letterboxd, you can go in and it tells you how many projects they've been in. and we'll give you a stat on how many you've watched of a specific person. For myself, I'm sitting at 33 of 114 projects. And I say projects because these aren't necessarily all feature length movies. There's a lot of short films and different, like sometimes behind the scenes making of featurettes get rolled into this letterbox list. 33 of 114, that's only 28%. I'm really far behind on these Nick Cage films. But even then, 33, that's a lot of films by one actor. Like, that's a career's worth right there. This guy keeps producing more.
Yep.
Pig, man. This movie, I believe, was filmed in late 2019. Obviously got caught up in the pandemic and has been pushed back to 2021. So timeline-wise, this comes out after Willy's Wonderland, and out right now. It's just, what a crazy film. This is directed by Michael Sarnowski. Not only directed, but written by Michael as well.
Can we make a note? This is his first movie. This is his debut film, too. Keep that in mind.
Jeez, that is wild. I feel like we're hitting a bit of a trend with some of these first-time directors or near first-time. Like, sometimes they've done a couple short films or something, but this is their feature-length directorial debut, and they are firing on all cylinders, man.
Oh, yeah.
Wow. Did you want to give any general thoughts on the movie before we jump into spoilers? And I'll basically hand it off to you to sort of go through a lot of the movie here.
Yeah, I mean, general impressions were that, I think this has got to be my favorite film from 2021 so far, by decent margin as well. It was just, it was not what I was, it was tough to tell from the trailer what to expect here, but whatever you're expecting, if you're going in blind, which I highly recommend, it's not what you're expecting at all. And that's in the best possible way.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I went in, I don't think I ever watched a trailer for this. Maybe a short trailer. I really didn't know anything about the plot of the film. I didn't know anything about it, the genre. I love going into something like this blind. Again, I'm bringing in some of that prejudice from Nick Cage hit and miss, you know, over the past 10, 15 years. So I really wasn't sure, oh, is this going to be a crazy out there Nick Cage performance, or is this going to be...
I thought you loved Dog Eat Dog.
I think Dog Eat Dog just about, like, this is why I think you're very brave for doing this project of Nick Cage, because I watched that with you a few years ago, and it's like, I don't know if I could sit through a lot of these ones, at least not alone. Like, if I was watching it with you or somebody else, it'd be a lot more bearable. So I'm kind of nervous going into these films. Like Willy's Wonderland. I was a little bit nervous going into Willy's Wonderland, right?
In Cage, we trust.
Pig? I mean, you, I think on Friday night, you sent me a message about Pig and like kept it pretty simple. And it's like, okay, I'm feeling a lot better about getting into this film.
Yeah.
Wow. So, I mean, with that, I mean, obviously, this is an incredible movie. I love this film.
Yeah, I think it sums it up. I think our text messages to each other, like after I watched it, was one word. It was, wow. Yeah. And then I think when you watched it the next night, you just texted back, wow.
Wow, yeah.
That pretty much sums it up.
Yeah. And if you ever look at like the ratings, I'm not going to look at Rotten Tomatoes here. I just have Letterboxd up. A 3.9 average rating so far. The movie's been out for a few weeks digitally. That's a really impressive high rating on this film. I think it is being critically acclaimed at this point. And Nick Cage, I mean, it's easy for fans to get behind this. I imagine audiences are going to love this film. With that, I mean, obviously, both recommend this movie. From here on out, let's say spoilers are fair game. We'll just get into the film. Where do you want to start? Like, the overall plot of this film is very simple. It's Nicolas Cage. I don't know if he's a truffle farmer. I think this description calls him a truffle hunter.
Truffle hunter.
He has a truffle pig, and he's basically getting truffles in the woods. He's selling them. He's living kind of this hermit lifestyle. He looks very rugged. He's got full Nick Cage, like full beard going on, super long hair. Like, this guy is a woodsman. And basically people come in and steal his pig. And that's pretty much all I knew about going into the film. This plays out within the first, 5-10 minutes of the movie. And without knowing anything about the movie, I initially thought, man, is this another John Wick thing here? Because you immediately get the impression this pig is, he's a friend of Nick Cage's character here, right? Like his name is Rob. Like he scratches his ears. It's just like he looks like a dog relationship. The pig is living in his cabin with him. And you don't, if Wick has told us anything, you don't mess with people's pets, right? And so I'm kind of expecting Nick Cage to go on a murderous rampage throughout this, but what I got was so much more, like just so much more engaging.
Yeah, like I like to think of this as kind of the anti-John Wick, mm-hmm. where it's like the same, very, I mean, I think people online have, you know, and reading other people's reviews and thoughts, they've come to it from the same angle where they saw in the trailer or the first couple minutes of the movie, and it's like, oh, you know, this man, this recluse, it was kind of removed himself from society. He's obviously suffering from some kind of loss, and like somebody, you know, either kills or steals his animal companion. And it's like, oh, of course, like John Wick has now set those expectations. Yeah. It's like, oh, it's going to be another mindless revenge kind of thriller, which is not to disparage the John Wick films. Like I'm a huge fan of action films, mm-hmm. and yeah. you know, I'm a huge fan of the John Wick movies. But I love that Pig was completely different than that. It wasn't an action movie. It wasn't a revenge movie. It turned out to be instead this really profound meditation on, you know, grief and loss and dealing with grief, you know, and that was, it kind of blew me away how profound the movie ended up being. Like there were a couple moments, I'm not going to lie, where like I was watching this and starting to tear up a little bit, you know, like yeah. There were some really moving moments that were really earned, by in terms of the story and in terms of the, you know, the character growth and the character arcs and the two main characters there, you know, you have Rob, AKA, Robin Fell, I believe is the full yeah. character's name, played by Nick Cage, who does, as we talked about, he does an amazing job. And I think the other character, Amir, who's played by Alex Wolff, who yep. you might recognize from a little film called Hereditary.
Yes. Amazing.
Yeah. And this guy is, I don't know how old this guy is. He's pretty young. I mean, but I'm talking about, I'm talking about from the perspective of somebody who's getting a little bit older here, but he yeah, seems right. like an up and coming. He seems like a guy to watch out for. Like
he's got some talent.
Yeah, some great performances here as well. But they kind of, it's kind of neat how at the beginning these characters seem so different, but they're really, their journeys to the film kind of mirror each other in terms yeah. of their journey of both self-discovery and figuring out who they are and their place in the world, and also in you know, processing and dealing with their relative losses and the grief that they're both going through.
Yeah, like there's no better example here. Like right at the beginning of the film, you know, Rob, Nicolas Cage is selling these truffles. Amir is his buyer, and he drives in yeah. in like this bright, bright yellow sports car. It's like
a Camaro.
A Camaro, yeah. And it's just like, oh, it looks so completely out of place. Rob's cabin is like from the earth. Everything is browns and greens. I mean, Rob himself looks like he just came out of a bush. And it's like these two people could not come from more different areas. I really like that juxtaposition between them. And they have a very simple relationship at that beginning, buyer and seller. It's like Nicolas Cage doesn't have any interest in even talking to this guy, really, aside from selling these truffles here.
Yeah, it's kind of neat how Amir is set up to be essentially Rob's intermediary Amir set up to be an intermediary between, you know, Rob, who's out in the natural world, he's literally living in the woods, and then, you know, the foodie scene, the high cuisine scene in Portland, Oregon. And so he's kind of, you know, Rob's connection to that world through his buying of truffles from him, right? Which we yeah. all know, for those people who don't know, like truffles are, you know, they're considered a delicacy. They're very hard to come by. They're very, like, very expensive, kind of very high end food ingredient, right?
So that's literally all I know about truffles.
There's a lot exactly of money involved in the truffle business here, right?
And that's the thing I didn't really realize the movie was going to be about either, is that Amir, this is his business, is rare and expensive ingredients for the cuisine, like the restaurant industry. And it's like, it's a whole level of restaurant industry that I am completely not, you know, familiar with at all. It's just like these fancy, fancy restaurants and stuff. It's just, it keeps making things like, oh man, like how are these guys connected here? And I don't know if I want to get too far on the plot here or whatever, but we basically discover that Rob came from this world, right? Like I love this slow rollout of Rob coming down. He's like, well, you know what? I've got a singular purpose now. I got to get my pig back.
Yeah.
He really doesn't care whose toes he step on, what happens. He's coming out with no cash. Amir basically has to drive him into the city. Amir doesn't want to be seen with this guy. He doesn't know who he is. He doesn't know his history. And it's just like this guy, you know, he's beaten up. And I love the initial blood he had from his face from being beaten up while his pig was being stolen is never removed basically throughout the film, right? Like this Rob does not care at all about image, perspectives, anything. He wants that pig back.
He doesn't care now. So there's two things going on with the reason, like he's constantly, so he gets beaten up initially or he gets assaulted really when the people steal his pig. And then throughout the movie, we'll get into in a little bit. I think it deserves its own kind of discussion here when he gets, you know, further beaten up. But I think the reason that he doesn't clean himself up is, yeah, now we learn that he doesn't care what people think anymore, right? So he's not concerned about appearances. But also it's kind of, you know, a fairly obvious kind of visual metaphor of kind of the inner kind of emotional kind of gunk and then dirt, yeah, and grime that are kind of marring him. And that's kind of reflected externally, right? So he's all the blood and grime and stuff is kind of a reflection of his internal emotional state, which is kind of an obvious visual metaphor, but it still works really well, right? And once you kind of, you know, get past that, it's part of the willing suspension of disbelief. But it also plays into another kind of larger theme in the movie, which is about, you know, breaking down these facades, right? It's about, we'll get into this a bit more later on, but it's about like, you know, kind of looking through or looking past all these kind of societal constructions about what we think is valuable. And then, you know, trying to look underneath of them for these, you know, simple truths, you know, the moments of, these moments of clarity, these moments of truth, which almost like, you know, like a fine meal, they're difficult to come across and they don't last forever. So you have to kind of enjoy them when they can. I think it was like deconstructing deconstruction in a sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Where we look later at when we talk about like the food scene and everything, there's a poignant scene, in a restaurant later on, but like it's about, you know, we're constantly deconstructing things and reconstructing things and looking for meaning. It's about kind of seeing through that facade, right?
Amazing.
Yeah. So after he goes into town, so they're in Portland. I think it was all filmed like actually on location in Portland, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. Yeah. So they finally go into town and I think he basically heads straight towards this old hangout, like this old place that he used to know.
Yeah, so he's got some contacts. I guess we're not getting too far ahead of ourselves when it's revealed later on that shortly after this that he used to be like a master chef.
Yeah.
In that, you know, high-end food world, that kind of foodie high cuisine world, and that I think it was about 10 years previous he disappeared from that world, went out and started living in the woods by himself with the pig, getting into the truffle business. Yeah. Right. So he's going back trying to find his pig, and he's got some contacts in that high end food world who would kind of have a beat on, you know, like this kind of thing.
Well, and I love that. I love how it plays out. Cause at this point, I still don't know what's going to happen. I don't know if he's going to pull out some crazy fighting style and start beating guys up. Right. The first guy he meets is someone he knows, obviously. Nick Cage leaves the tent where they're in, and so he sort of gets his first lead. And Amir is kind of standing there, and his contact, who just spoke with him, turns to Amir. Is just like, do you even know this guy's real name? Right? It's like clearly Amir doesn't know this guy's history, but all these other people do, and that quickly brings him to essentially this underground fight club.
Well, it's almost like, again, it's almost like an anti fight club.
Yes. So in this one, I think, what is it? I got the impression you put your name down. So Rob puts his name on the board. Everyone immediately recognizes it. The crowd goes silent. The organizer knows who Rob is. And I think the structure of this is basically the spectators here, they bid on how much they want to pay to beat this person up for 60 seconds.
Yeah, that's what it looks
like.
And
if the person can survive, they will get a pile of cash. So essentially, Rob puts his name down and someone throws a ton of cash on it and just proceeds to beat Rob up for 60 seconds. Again, it's just that bloody face that he carries throughout the rest of the movie. And I think it's at that point Amir is starting to catch on. It's like, oh, like people are really reacting to this guy as soon as he put his full name, like Robin Feld.
I think it's Robin Fell, I think.
Oh, Feld. Yeah. So it's just Robin Feld.
Feld, F-E-L-D.
Yeah. So Amir starts piecing together that Robin Feld is a name. And it's also not entirely clear to me at this point in time that Amir is... like his job is so reliant on having contacts and relationships with different people. So he would know these different people in the woods. He would know all these people all where to get these special, rare, expensive ingredients. And he's basically trying to connect people all the time.
Yeah.
And that he is being slighted. He doesn't know all the connections that Robin has. It's almost like this thing is like, oh, this guy is kind of a, you know, small time, right?
Well, yeah, he's kind of standing in awe of him, but that whole kind of fight scene. So it's kind of weird. A lot of people have actually taken this and said, it's like, I can get behind everything else in the movie, but for some reason, this fight scene or this scene of violence doesn't quite fit with the rest of the movie. And I can get that. I can see how it might seem a little bit out of place, but I think it fits really well with the theme and it fits really well with what's going on. Because what happened was the first time he went to that guy, so the person that he went to get information about his stolen pig, who's running this restaurant, and he, it's also kind of note, he brings him like an offering of food. Instead of like,
yes,
there's no violence, there's no threats. It's like he brings him this offering of food. So food plays a big part of this, right? And he kind of takes a taste of it, gives it back to him. And he tells him, like, you have no value anymore, right? Like, you don't exist. Mm-hmm. And so this is the same guy who's running that underground fight club. So literally, like, they're having to, that is Rob and Amir, they're literally having to descend into an underworld, right? Which is a common motif in, you know, in storytelling and narrative storytelling. And it's also in line with the emotional state of these characters who are both going through grief of different ways, right? And then there's a bunch of things going on with this fight, right? One is there's a penance that Rob is kind of paying, right? You get the sense that in his past that he may not have been the nicest person, right?
Mm-hmm.
That he may have been almost like a Gordon Ramsay type kind of character who, you know, yelled at his staff and berated people, wasn't the nicest. And so this is a way of essentially, because when he writes his name on the board, people know who he is and they pay a lot of money to go and beat him up. And you get the impression that the guy who's actually, you know, laying the beat down on this guy, he knew him. It was somebody that Rob had wronged at some point, right? And so it's almost like he's descending into the underworld and he's suffering this punishment. He's also showing like what he's willing to go through to get his pig back. And I think somebody else pointed out online that it was also potentially a commentary on the food industry as a whole and how kind of cutthroat it can be and how abusive it can be to some of the workers, and it's almost like a refutation of, you see this romanticized kind of TV version of these master chefs as, you know, like the tortured kind of genius, like Gordon Ramsay, who yells at his staff, but it's okay because he's really good at what he does. But you look at it from the other side of the coin, it's like, it's never okay to treat people that way. You can't justify that in any way. And so it was kind of deconstructing or demythologizing, you know, like that mythology that's been built up on reality TV. And it's been reinforced by the media of this image of like
that's really interesting.
Of the genius who can, you know, get away with being antisocial and insulting people because of his genius. And it's kind of being like, well, no. It doesn't matter what you bring to the table. You can't, it's not ethical to treat people that way. And I think specifically read online about people involved in the food industry and some of their horror stories, and like, you know, the low pay and the long hours, and like in some cases literal like sexual harassment and abuse, yeah. Physical abuse, emotional abuse that people have to undertake, not just at the low level of like, you know, like working in a McDonald's or something, but working in the high end restaurants, studying under Master Chef. So it's kind of demythologizing on that a little bit, and going back to that deconstruction of those myths, right?
Yeah, that's a fantastic articulation here, an expansion on the scene, like definitely more depth than I pulled out of it initially here. I love that you could explain it like that.
And then the result of that scene, though, is also that Nick Cage pulls himself up at the floor, beaten and bruised and bloody, and he, you know, limps over to, the gentleman running this underground fight club or anti-fight club, and he's like, essentially showed what he's willing to go through. And so the guy gives him this piece of paper with a name on it, and the next contact to go in the chain, in the food chain to figure out where his pig is.
And I think after that, Rob basically spends the night at Amir's place, and they're having breakfast the next day. And that's when Amir is able to open up a little bit about his family. They sort of talks about his father and how much of an awful person he is. His mother committed suicide years before, which would really come into play later on in the film. But Rob basically asks him, all right, you have to get us reservations at a restaurant called Eurydice. And we quickly discover that is Amir's, like one of Amir's father's like hot spots for doing business.
Yeah, it's important to point out that Amir and his father, I think his father is Darius, played by Darius. Adam Arkin.
Yeah.
He's also, this plays into the theme as well, but Amir and Darius are in the same business of tracking down truffles and presumably other high-end ingredients and, you know, dealing them to these, you know, high-end restaurants. So it's important that we find out that in that conversation at Amir's house that Rob did indeed used to be this master chef. Mm-hmm. Amir says that his mother committed suicide. C, that he talks about that he's in the same business as his father, and that he's obviously very living in his father's shadow and even afraid of his father.
Yeah. And so obviously the scene at the restaurant, I don't know if I was supposed to be laughing as much as I was in this movie. I did find there were a lot of comic elements to it.
I think some black comedy,
kind
right?
of darkly so.
Yeah.
But yeah, basically this restaurant scene is bonkers, and I'll let you expand on the meaning of this thing, but just essentially like they're served this preposterous meal of like, just, I don't even know what it was, but
deconstructed scallops.
Yeah. And it's just like, all right. Obviously there's a lot of stuff going on there. Rob asks to speak to the head chef. Derek comes out and doesn't recognize Rob at first, and they just sort of like start getting into it. And Rob, as soon as Derek recognizes Rob, and it's revealed that Derek used to work as a pastry chef for Rob many, many years, like 10, 15 years ago. And actually Rob fired him because he wasn't able to cook his pasta properly or something, right? He was a pasta chef, not a pastry chef, right?
Yeah.
I'm not sure. In any event, he basically emasculates this guy for 4 or 5 minutes on scene, really breaking, like, just like the deconstructed scallops, he's deconstructing this guy's character. And it's like, it goes back to that Fight Club thing where it's just like, 10 years ago, you were working for me, and all you wanted to do was open up like an authentic English pub. And it's just like you've opened up instead this fancy restaurant that isn't real. And he keeps saying that none of this is real. But he's like inferring the English pub would be real. It's like, what happened? And Derek is basically broken down step by step to the point where it's just like, yeah, like that was my dream. And it's like, people don't want that. It's like people want this fake stuff all the time, and it's not authentic. And you really get the impression it's like, you know, Rob, part of the reason of leaving this whole industry is just how fake all of it is. Like he says, the food is fake, the critics are fake, the customers are fake, everything about it is fake. But please, like, expand on this scene, because it was pretty brilliant, I thought.
Well, I think this is, like, as most people pointed out, or most people recognize, this is kind of a pivotal scene in the movie, not just in terms of narrative, but in terms of, like, the actual themes and what's going on. Going back to that deconstruction, right? So you have, you know, this very fancy, high-end restaurant, and it's, like, this very kind of fancy dish, where it's literally served, it's like deconstructed scallops, and it's like literally served, like, it's smoked, like steamed with like this pine cone, and like the server, she takes the sort of like this glass cover that she takes off, and it's like disappears, and it's like, and then you ask to see the chef, like you said, comes out, and it's not so much about that the meal itself was somehow fake or inauthentic, but it's about the pretense that this chef was putting on, right? That he comes out and he starts, you know, asking about, and this is great. He asks him, like, what's the concept here?
Yeah.
Right? What's the concept here? And he kind of fumbles around a little bit about, you know, taking familiar elements and deconstructing them and making the familiar kind of unfamiliar. He goes on about this kind of, in the really kind of pretentious kind of foodie kind of language. And then Nicolas Cage, like you say, I don't think it's about emasculating him though, but he does kind of start to deconstruct him, right? He, you know, starts to, because he remembers, he's got this memory, right? And he brings it up again later, Rob does, that is, about like, I remember every meal I cook for every person, right? Because it meant something to him, right?
Yeah.
And he's like, and I remember you, even though you only worked for me for 2 months, you wanted to open an English pub, which is not like fancy high cuisine, but it was something that guy wanted to do. And he looks around, he says, like, you know, like, look around. These customers, they don't care about you. Like, they're not real. The food critics aren't real. Like, all the accoutrement in this restaurant, all the decoration and decor, this isn't real. And I think there's a really telling line that got to me personally. It was like, you know, these people don't know the real you because you haven't shown them, right? Because you're hiding behind all this artifice that you obviously don't believe in, because he keeps asking him and the guy keeps denying. He's like, I don't think I wanted to open an English pub. It's like, no, I don't think so. Like, that's not really, it wasn't a big dream. But then there's this really, like, the telling scene where you can tell that he's really gotten to him, where he asks, like, what was the signature dish you were going to serve at your English pub? And like immediately without hesitation, he breaks down. It's like, I can't remember what the name of the dish was, but it was very specific. And he breaks it down. He blurts it out. Like, it's on the tip of his tongue. Like, it's still buried there, this dream. Right. And so it's like, you can see that he's living in this artificial world that he's constructed, and he's doing this thing. He's a great chef, but he's doing it not because he loves it, but because it feels like he has to do it in order to sell, right? He's doing what other people, or what he thinks other people want to see from him. And it's about, and the point Rob is making is about, like, looking underneath and, you know, like, life's too short, that you have to look for those moments of, you have to look for that realness and that authenticity and, like, you know, live the life that you want to live, not the life that you think other people want you to live, and finding that authentic self, kind of, that we tend to bury underneath kind of these layers of artifice and pretense. Right. And I think he breaks him down a little bit, but he does it in a gentle way. And it's almost like he gives him this gift, right? Of like, you know, like helping him kind of rediscover who he is. You can see, like, the actor does, who performs that, I can't remember what the actor's name is, who plays Derek, but like, you can see in his face, there's so much going on. You can see, like, almost like his spirit kind of almost breaking down as he goes through and realizing it's like, he's kind of been wasting his life in a sense, because he's not been true to himself.
Yeah, and it's really fascinating, because he worked with Rob for 2 months, as you said. Like, Rob fired him for not being able to cook this pasta all the way through all the time. But the fact that Rob still remembers him after all these years, like 10 or 15 years, and Rob is where he is in the world. Like, he's basically renowned in Portland here as this master chef. Like, this is advice directly from the chef here that he probably dismissed, he probably hated this guy for ages because of this. And here he is basically being broken down, being encouraged to go back out and follow your dreams, right? It's like, Rob has followed his dreams of becoming a master chef and doing his thing, and he's following his new dream there, or what have you, of doing this other stuff here. But it's just like, you were, and only because I'm thinking of watching Hell's Kitchen and Master Chef and stuff.
Yeah.
Gordon Ramsay will give them, you know, if they make it far enough at the competition, they'll give them. And it's just like, well, listen, this meal was garbage, but you have a lot of skill and I want to see you succeed. And it's just like, that encouragement is enough to make these people who are passionate about their industry, like these chefs are so full of passion that it's enough for them to really keep going and do what they really want to do.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like a new sentiment. I mean, you have, like, in Shakespeare, right, to thy own self be true. So this mm-hmm. is kind of it's a fundamental truth, though, that I think bears repeating. But also you get the sense, because by this point we kind of understand that you know, Rob lost his wife, and that's one of the reasons that he maybe mm-hmm. left the industry, was because he's speaking from experience. When he's speaking to Derek, he's not doing it to be mean. He's speaking from mm-hmm. experience, because he was in that world, right? He was in that you know, high-end cuisine. He was one of those master chefs. And when his wife died, he realized what was really important to him. And it wasn't yeah. that world. And so instead of, you know, keeping up with that artifice and that pretense, that loss really helped him to put in perspective what was really important for him. And that's when he left the scene and went out to, you know, live in the woods, isolate himself, living that life and truffle hunting, which isn't necessarily the way that everyone is going to deal with grief and loss. But for him, it was, you know, being true to himself and being authentic to himself. And I think that was the important yeah. thing, where he's speaking, you get the sense where he's speaking from experience, right?
Pretty incredible. Like, that was a very, like, powerful scene. Yeah. If you had not really, like, known what was going on with the movie, like, if you were kind of wishy-washy up until that point, that scene would sell you. This is a movie that is working above and beyond any of your previous expectations, right?
Yeah.
I guess, like, I feel bad for just saying, moving on from this scene. I mean, Derek, this poor head chef, who hopefully gets to turn his life around and follow his dream.
I'm looking for the sequel where Derek opens an English pub.
Yeah, exactly. He tells him that Darius is responsible for taking Rob's pig.
Yep.
And this is, I mean, it's kind of earth shattering. This is kind of brutal, because Rob knows Amir's father is Darius. Like, he knows all this stuff going on. And it's just like, oh, your father stole my pig, and he probably did it through you. Like, if it wasn't for Amir buying Rob's truffles and having that business relationship, his pig probably would have been safe. And he gets
yeah.
really upset. He kicks the yellow Camaro, marks it all up, and he ends their professional relationship at that point, right? And then goes and steals a bicycle because he has no ride around town anymore.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it was, and it's revealed in one of the next couple scenes coming up, where Amir wasn't, I think he just mentioned it in passing to his father, that he had a connection named Rob who lived yeah. out in the woods, who was getting him truffles. And I think Darius, because of Robin's reputation, was able to put two and two together and figure out, this yeah. is the person.
Well, that's the thing, is Amir is in the dark on a lot of it. I don't think he knew about Rob before. Like, he is joining this industry later on. Like, obviously he didn't know Rob who it was, and his relationship with his father is so poor that Darius would know who Rob is, but keep that knowledge, like, knowledge is power, and would hold that over Amir without him even knowing that power is being held over him, right? It's like, at any moment Darius could go in and just wipe Amir out from that relationship, basically, which is kind of what he did.
Right. Yeah. So the next scene, so there's a couple things revealed. So one thing that's revealed is that Amir goes to visit his mother, who is not dead, but she's in a state. I think it's implied that she's, like, brain dead, essentially, and she's on yep. this respirator, and she's in this long-term care facility. So she's still being kept alive, presumably at the behest of his father, Darius.
Yeah.
And so, like, he goes there and he's standing by the door, and the nurse comes, like, oh, do you want to come and visit her? And he's like, no, it's okay. He kind of steps back. So you see he's trying to deal with a different kind of loss, different kind of grief, but he's still kind of like Rob, where he's not really processing mm-hmm. it, going through that, you know, proper emotional stages of grief and being able to process it properly. And then another scene comes up where Rob finally meets up with Darius, and they have their little sit down.
They have a sit down, and I mean, basically, Darius is just, I mean, this guy is a villain. Like, he's a jerk. He offers Rob money for the pig and goes back and forth, and it's just like, Rob's not having any of it. He just wants the pig. And I think Darius is like, okay, you know what? You leave right now. I'm going to have $25,000 dropped off at your shack for you tomorrow, and we'll just never speak of this pretty much ever again.
It's also interesting here where he talks about why he had the pig stolen was because his son had followed in his footsteps in the industry, right? In the same business, the truffle hunting or the truffle dealing business, or like maybe high-end ingredient dealing business. And then he tells Rob, he's like, yeah, my son's not cut out for this, so I'm just going to, you know, sabotage his career. And you know, I'm going to set him up with a nice desk job somewhere where it's something that's appropriate for him. So it's like his father's trying to control his life kind of surreptitiously like this. And there's something very sinister, like you said, about the way Darius is going about his sense of entitlement and his ability and willingness to manipulate people around him, and specifically the people he cares about, right? Where he's specifically, he didn't have a great relationship with his wife, but he's keeping her alive on extended life support, even though she's, you know, in all respects gone. He's distant from his son and actively sabotaging his son's career and like trying to shape his fate. So there is something kind of sinister going on with this character, right?
Without a doubt. And I think Amir verbally, like when he's at his mother's care facility, like verbalizes, it's just like, Dad, I need you to let her go, like let her die. Amir needs that closure.
Right? Yeah.
And I also like this thing throughout the movie, Amir, he's dressed nicely. His apartment is big and open and like overlooking the city. Like by all accounts, Amir is very successful to us. And that's, it's still not good enough for his father. It's just like, man, just let your son do it. He's obviously doing pretty well.
Yeah.
And I don't know how long he's been in it, but he's still sabotaging him. Like this guy is, he's just a jerk. I have no other safer words.
Just a meanie head.
He's just a meanie. Yeah. But so after those two scenes, like Rob leaves Darius, Amir visits his mother. I think at that point, Rob basically drops like a fairly significant piece of knowledge on Amir, and also like really is his way of opening up to Amir on a different level here. Rob admits that he doesn't need the truffle pig. He doesn't need the pig to find these truffles.
Yeah.
It's like he is so good at what he does. He can find these truffles without the pig. He just loves the pig because of the companionship. He just loves
it. Yeah, well, I think there's a couple things going on, and this is... where like you see really the nuance and the greatness of Cage's acting, where he talks about, there's a line like literally, I think he's like, yeah, I love the pig, or I love her.
Yeah.
And it's like in a lot of other actors' hands, like could have come off as like corny or cheesy or laughable, but when he says it, you can see the emotion and you can see like he means that, right? And you finally get the sense, it's like, oh, you know, it's not a truffle pig, right? He can find the truffles himself. And the pig is really, what the pig is, it's an emotional surrogate for his wife, essentially, right? Where instead of dealing with the grief and the loss of his wife, that he's found a way to kind of, you know, distract himself with his companionship with this pig, right? And so like this pig has become his world in a sense.
It's amazing because we don't see the pig on screen very much. Like she's on screen for a few minutes at the beginning. Yeah. We don't see a lot of that relationship. We don't hear Rob talking about the pig that much, but he, like Nicolas Cage, absolutely sells it in that moment. I'm getting goosebumps just thinking about it, where it's just like, man, I 100% believe, like I understand this relationship between this guy and his pig all of a sudden. And it was just like, oh my God, this is incredible. This is incredible.
Yeah. And then there's this essentially like the gearing up scene in the movies.
God, this is a whole other thing. Yeah, he gears up like he's going to
battle.
Basically tells Amir, we are going to make a meal. Yeah. And it's just, Amir's like, what are we doing? He's like, we're gonna make a meal. It's just like, here we
so
go.
So it's important to note that earlier when Amir was talking to Rob about his parents, he said that there was this one. They would go out to restaurants, high-end restaurants all the time, but they always come back fighting. Because he remembers in his childhood, his parents were fighting a lot. There wasn't a great relationship. They go out, they have their date nights, but they just come back fighting. But there was this one time, just one meal they had.
Yeah. So significant.
And they came back and like they were laughing and they're having a great time, a great night. Yeah. And they said they literally talked about this meal for years afterwards.
Yeah.
And like, and then you start to put the pieces together where Rob's like, I never forgot. And I remember every meal I cooked for every customer. It's like it's starting to come together now. And it's like, oh.
Oh my God. So he makes this meal and he taps into an old, like some other contacts for like a baguette. The salted baguette, very important. Basically makes this meal and the scene is just like, just played off so, so beautifully. Like he's just.
Yeah. Sorry. This cooking scene with Rob and Amir. This is one of the scenes that.
Very touching.
Yeah. This is one of the scenes that got me teared up a little bit. Specifically because essentially what happens is that, you know, Amir has been looking for this father figure his whole life.
Yeah.
And Rob essentially in that scene, where he's teaching him how to cook, is going through these steps and like there he's essentially becoming like a surrogate father figure for him. But it's also that they're starting to, it's the beginning where they're starting to be able to become emotionally literate. And it's the beginning of them being able to kind of, you know, that they've kind of latched onto each other and have that support structure that is going to allow them to begin to process the grief that they're going to have to deal with following them in the next couple scenes here.
Yeah. And it's also, we kind of, well, not that we missed it, but basically we see earlier in the film, Amir doesn't know how to cook anything. Basically he's trying to make French toast for Rob and he, you know, he apologizes because it's burnt or something. And it's just kind of a throwaway line Rob has. It's just like, well, you use stale bread is why it didn't turn out very well. And it's like, that's how inexperienced Amir is. He doesn't recognize that his bread is stale before cooking with it. So it makes that scene much more powerful. It's like, not only is his father in the restaurant business and would clearly know how to cook and know what good food is, never passed any of that stuff down to his son. Yeah. Like, and Amir is just following in his father's footstep, probably idolized him as most of us did with our fathers when we were children and wanted to do what he did. So seeing that scene play out and him finally getting a chance at the surrogate father with Rob is just, it's something else right there.
Yeah.
It's really nice. And then the dinner is served. And this is also a very powerful scene.
Yeah.
I didn't fully clue in at this time that it's like, oh, this is going to be the same dinner that he served to him before. I kind of forgot that he's just like, oh, I remember every meal I served. And he sort of explains it after this. But Darius is like halfway through this meal and he just breaks down crying halfway through this meal. It's just like, wow, Rob is a really good cook. But no, it's Rob made the exact same meal for Darius that him, like Darius and his wife enjoyed. That's the only time in their marriage that they were ever happy.
Yeah.
Just absolutely deconstructed that guy on the spot.
Yeah. It's kind of neat. Where it's like, he brings out like this bottle of wine that he had Amir help track down. It's like this old, like this, where it's like, I think they had a couple of times that they had wine and it's like, oh, it's like, whatever. It was a good wine. But it's like, he pulls out this like bottle of wine that he had some contact saving for him. He's going through this gearing up scene. He gets all these, you know, nice ingredients. So they go to this guy's house, sneak into his dad's house, cook this meal, and they call him out. And he's like, without a couple words at the beginning, he's like, you know, let's eat or whatever. And then, yeah, like Darius just breaks down and he runs off. He's like, I want you out of my house. Get out of my house. And he runs off to his office. He's breaking down. He's being forced to confront, you know, his pain and his loss from losing his wife essentially, but not being able to let go. Right. And I think he says at one point, I think their first meeting after he kicks Rob out of the house, Rob says, something along the lines of, were you always like this? Or was it only after your wife, you know, killed herself?
Yeah.
And so that's significant here because it all kind of ties back to that, like how they're dealing with that grief and that loss and how that comes into play. And so Rob follows Darius into his office. Rob and Amir follow him in. You know, ask him again, is like, you know, like, do you know where my pig is? I want my pig. Yeah. And that's when Darius reveals that unfortunately the two people who kidnapped his pig were a little bit too rough with it. And they had to euthanize the pig because it was in such rough shape.
Heartbreaking.
Yeah. Like right there is like Darius is dealing with his grief and he's crying. And then like, you see like everything kind of goes silent and, you know, Rob, Nicolas Cage lets out this you know, this mournful wail, and he kind of like tears roll down his face, and he kind of collapses on the ground with the weight of, yeah, of this knowledge, that the grief that his, you know, this thing that he loved, or this, you know, this individual that he loved is dead and gone, is, yeah, not coming back. And you see all of a sudden, it's like everything clicks into place where, you know, Darius and Amir are trying to, you know, deal with, you know, having to let go of their, you know, wife slash mother, and that Rob is really, you know, in dealing with, you know, losing that pig, he's really being forced to deal with loss of his wife, essentially, right?
Absolutely powerful.
Yeah.
And heartbreaking. Like, he really wanted the pig to come back. Like, he wanted them to be reunited, but it's like the cold reality sets in. Yeah. The movie continues on. Amir drives Rob back home. At which point Rob is just like, well,
not quite, right? They're at a little diner.
Yes.
And there's an important conversation, kind of a denouement, where Rob says, I wish I hadn't come looking for the pig.
Because in
my mind, she would have still been alive. But yeah. Amir says to him, but she wouldn't really, though. And you can tell at that, you know, at that moment, you know, like, you can see exactly how, like, dealing with this loss, like, you know, like, if you look at, like, the seven stages of grief and, like, you know, denial and anger and bargaining and all these things, you can kind of, I don't know if grief is ever can be, you know, properly slotted into those easy categories, but I think there are some, you know, common elements to how we grieve. And, you know, for those two there, like, after that conversation, it's like, oh, it's about acceptance, right? The first step is, like, accepting that part of your life is gone, that person is gone. And then for Rob, it's about, you know, he goes back out into the woods on his way to his cabin. He stops. He finally goes in this creek. He washes himself, gone all the blood and the grime and all that stuff. He starts that process of healing, of letting go, of letting all that stuff go, right? Of washing all that away from him. And for Amir, he gets into his car, and this whole time he's been listening to these, essentially, like, these audio recordings about, like, teaching why classical music is so great. Again, going to that high, like, the idea of, like, the pretense, right? That artifice of, like, trying to like something or enjoy something that you don't actually like or enjoy because it's supposed to be high art or whatever it is, right? And he turns off the tape or the recording, because the tapes don't exist. It's 2021.
Yeah.
And he just, like, he leans, you know, he puts the seat back of his car, and he just, like, curls up and then puts his head down, like, he's not moving. He's not going to sell anything or buy anything. He's not listening to, you know, trying to like the music his father is trying to like, because, like, his father also likes classical music that comes into play. He's just sitting there silently, you know, allowing himself to process the loss of his mother, right? And so, like, you see these characters finally able to begin that process of healing and acceptance and going through that necessary, you know, that grief. And then that powerful scene where Rob at the end, he goes through and he does have a tape, because he's in the middle of the woods.
Like a literal tape, like,
And he's at, like, his wife obviously made them in this recording, and he puts it on, and he, like, gets in the bed, and he looks down at, like, the bed where the pig used to live, and kind of, like, drifts off to sleep. But it's, like, the simple, really simple imagery, but so, so powerful.
Yeah, it was really fantastic. Yeah, listening to Rob listening to his wife singing, that's basically how the movie fades to black, with a very touching rendition of that song. It was really solid. And of course, just before all that, Rob renews his partnership with Amir
and says, yes, exactly,
I'll see you next Thursday. Because Amir is maybe thinking, well, this is it, like, this is the end. But it's like, it was important that Amir and Rob continue to have a relationship. The relationship has deepened more than their professional one, but it was still see you next Thursday. And I can walk away from the movie thinking they might hang out for the afternoon this time. Maybe they'll go into town. Who knows? They'll have a much better emotive relationship than they did in the past. And both of them have been able to move on from both of their grief process in some closure.
Well, I think that there's something to be said there about having that kind of support system in place, where you lose somebody, but then to help you get through that process is about building up new connections with other people around you and having that, you know, like, people to lean on when necessary. Like, you can't just, it's not healthy to go and cut yourself off and live alone in the woods, even if it's with a pig that you really love or something, you know, like, it's the pig was a replacement, you know, and now he's, you know, it seems that they've developed genuine, human connection. And that's part of the healing process, too, I think.
Yeah. Absolutely phenomenal.
Yeah.
Definitely much more than I think either one of us or really anyone is really expecting. Harkening back to some of that prejudice that you go into with a Nick Cage movie in the 2010s, in that a lot of them can be hit or miss. It's like this one is so much of a hit that it catches you off guard. Like if I was standing watching this movie, I would have fallen over.
Yeah.
you know what I mean? Incredible.
It was so, yeah. Listen, like I said before, like I love big action movie or like a revenge thriller, but it was so refreshing to see, here's this person, you know, dealing with this loss and this grief, not through more violence, but through nonviolent means of talking to people, like the simple act of sharing a meal with somebody or sharing that food, which is so powerful. I think one of the things in that scene where people talk about, I think that the sense of smell is the one most closely linked to memory, and taste and smell are closely linked, right? So like the fact that his tool to help break people down or to help, you know, interact with people is food, of using, you know, smell and taste to link to those memories, these nonviolent means. There's something so refreshing about that, right? Where like there's other modes of dialogue between the typical American action hero of going and beating people up and beating, you know, going and killing 100 men because they killed your dog kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
So it's like so refreshing from the normal kind of Hollywood mainstream, I guess.
Yeah. But it is kind of nice to have this representation, the showcase of, you know, how do men emote with each other? Like this is a fairly men-centric film.
Definitely.
And obviously, you know, Amir and Darius, father and son, like don't get along. They're not able to connect to one another, and being able to see Amir and Rob being able to connect and eventually emote with one another in a way that is often, I don't know if it's frowned upon, but it's not like societal standard in Western culture to sort of do what they do.
Well, I think I don't know if it's an intentional connection, but I believe that Chuck Palahniuk is from Portland, and his book Fight Club was specifically, he talked about how it was a way of like, you know, essentially, you know, creating a modern kind of mythology where, you know, men could find an outlet for their emotions in a socially acceptable way. And I don't know if that was intentional, that he knew that the filmmaker knew that Chuck Palahniuk was from Portland, and that there was some, you know, Fight Club, very different movie, but there's some similar themes in terms of like that kind of, you know, male, that kind of modern template for men to be able to express their emotions in a socially acceptable way. So I don't know. Maybe I'm reaching. I don't know.
You mentioned it. Like it almost seems like there has to be a connection, because obviously that whole scene,
that whole anti-fight club,
the underground Fight Club, like that's all I could think about. It's like, oh, look at this, this like upheaval of the entire Fight Club movie taking place on screen. It was just like, there has to be some form of connection there, but it obviously goes so much. It goes so much deeper into a different area.
There's so many, like, you look at, and this is the thing too, is like I had my own interpretations, and then like I was reading other people, their reviews of what was going on, and there were so many different takes, and then I was like, oh, that's really neat. And then it cut, and then I went back and bounced my own ideas off, and like I started thinking more about it, and it was just like there's so much to think about in this movie, and like the more you go back and revisit it, like just the more there is to dig your teeth into. It's like it is like a fine meal. And I love that last meal, because I know like there was that scene where he talked about, it was like, oh, like, you know, what's the concept here? And it seemed like, oh, he was refuting entirely fine dining. But then he goes and makes that meal. And it's not about refuting the fine dining experience. It's about, you know, cook and eat what you want to cook and eat, as long as it's authentic to what you like, right? Yeah. So it's like, it's okay to make this fine dining. I think, I don't know if it's pheasant or whatever, but he cooks these really fancy meal himself.
Yeah.
But it's because he seems to love to cook that. I love those little like nods at the beginning where he makes that pastry and he make the little mushroom pastry at the beginning. It's like, this guy actually has some skills. And it's like, oh, little hints like that. But he loves doing that. So it's not a complete refutation. It's like, oh, deconstructed scallops are stupid. It's like, it was a terrible idea because that guy didn't want to do it. He was doing it because he thought other people wanted to do it, right?
Yeah, you talked about some of the little hints and things here. I love that the film was able to convey so much through action and very little dialogue. Like, Nicolas Cage's character is not very outspoken, or there's not a lot of
no, there's not a lot of dialogue. He's not very loquacious.
Yeah, there you go. There's not a lot of context going on through that. Like, nothing is telling you exactly what is happening. There's no character that is going to sit here and explain who Rob is in the culinary world, right? It's just like it.
Yeah, there's also no exposition. There's no like Dr. Exposition
comes out, is it? Yeah.
And says like, oh, well, what you're going through means this, this, and these are the themes of the movie that we're talking about right now. It's like, no, there's none of that. It's like, it's presented this story and it's left to us to like go through. And you can tell by the reactions online from people. It's like, people are making those connections themselves. This is a movie that trusts an audience, right? Has that intellectual respect, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Might I say, this movie is 90 minutes long. Like, it packs in so much into this 90 minutes that it's like, it is a barometer at this point. If I can watch a movie and have zero desire to like reach out and check my phone. I never once checked the time. I didn't want to know what the weather was doing outside. I didn't want anything. I just watched this movie for 92 minutes straight, and I'm just sitting there watching the credits, and it's like, I don't even know what to do with myself at this point.
Yeah.
It's Saturday night, and I usually watch like a second movie, but like a double feature Saturday. It's like, there's nothing I can pair up with this movie that is going to compare to this. Like, this is in some way kind of ruined the rest of my night.
No,
here.
Pig is kind of like a fine wine where you have to let it breathe. Like, you have to give it, it's like a fine meal. You have to give it time. Like, let your palate, you know, fully appreciate what's going on. Like you said, like I was sitting there after through the whole credits, because there's some music playing and then it kind of goes silent, right?
Yeah.
And you're just sitting there. And like, even after the credits finished rolling, and I was just like, I didn't know what to do next. I had to sit there. I was sitting there for a while, just like thinking about what I had seen. It was like, there's so much to process. And I was trying to articulate what it meant. And I had to like push that aside and just like, let it kind of pass through me and start to digest it first, right? Using all these food metaphors, but
I mean, did you write all these down?
No, but it's also not unintentional. But yeah, it's like, it took a while to digest before I could even start putting my thoughts together on this thing. It was an incredible experience. And like I said, like, I think this was easily the best film I've seen come out in 2021 so far, even though I think you said it was originally filmed in 2019. It's the best 2021 release, I think, that I've seen so far.
With all that being said, like, what's your star rating out of this, out of 5 stars?
Okay, so I gave this a 4.5 out of 5, and then on Letterboxd I gave it the extra heart.
Oh, the heart on there on top.
That's, so yeah, that's very good. I don't know, a very few movies that I'll give like 5 out of 5 on the first viewing, but I could easily see myself getting bumped up to a 5 out of 5 movie. Like, it was,
yeah,
like, I don't know, what was your rating on this thing?
Honestly, like, I do have this thing we talk about every so often. It's just like, even with Censor, I just mentioned, I gave it 4.5 stars initially. And it's like, after we're talking, it's like, why wouldn't I give this 5 stars? Right? It's just like, I shouldn't be ashamed to do that. I should just do it. I loved walking out of both of these films. And Pig, you know what? I'm not going to beat around the bush here. I'm just going to give it straight up 5 stars.
Nice.
First viewing, it is part of a very select few movies that get that initial 5 stars right out the gate. And I think that's pretty significant. This one, I'm really excited to watch it again. I might give it a little more time. Like you say, let it,
digest,
let it digest. And maybe I'll watch it in 4 or 5 months again. Yeah. But geez, 5 stars easily for me. I'm not going to give it the heart. The heart for me is going to be reserved for multiple viewings, I think.
Yeah. But yeah, easily. Yeah. It was one of the, like, topped off my charts pretty quickly here. Yeah. Definitely recommend. As soon as this thing comes out on, Blu-ray/UHD, I'm picking this thing up like 100%. Like, this goes on the priority list. Like, this is not just because it's an incredible performance by Nick Cage and people are, you know, talking about, you know, award season and stuff. And like, I'm not big into all the awards and everything, but if you're going to give an award to somebody this year for a performance, like, give it to Nicolas Cage. I mean, come on.
Well, I hope it does get recognition. Like, yeah, I'm not watching the Oscars. I'm not watching all these other award shows. They are what they are. They're kind of in the same vein of these fancy meals. Like, they kind of feel fake to me to some degree. But I would like some recognition. I would like to see him get recognized for this role. I want to see this director get recognized, not only writing it, but directing it. And this is a feature directorial debut.
What was the director's name again?
Michael Sarnowski.
Yeah, Michael Sarnowski. So watch out for this guy's name. I think one of the smart things he did with this movie was he didn't try to do anything too crazy, too intense. He kept things like pretty simple. I think you could almost see Pig playing out almost like as a stage play. Almost, it was like that. Very simple in its production design, very simple in its staging. And I think that was an excellent choice. That, you know, from a first time director, keep things simple. Focus on the theme and the character. Don't worry about special effects or action or, you know, having to go to the location and shoot in Rome or whatever it is. You know, like he did a really great job. And there's like shots, there's some really neat shots in there. Like when you first see Rob and the pig together and they're framed in the doorway of the house with the camera looking out from the house as they're standing in front of the, like just really some really kind of neat cinematography going on there too. It's really cool. As a debut movie, especially, mind blown. Like this guy, like incredible, incredible stuff.
Do you have anything else to add to this?
I think people are getting tired of hearing me talk about Pig by now.
Well, I mean, you were able to articulate it so well. It's just like, there's a lot of, it's one of those movies where I'm watching it and I watch some of these scenes and be like, I can't put my finger on it. I can't articulate myself why the scene is so good, but I know I'm watching greatness.
Yeah.
And I think you help bring that out. That much more so like in the analysis afterwards, just like here are the different layers of why this scene is working. If you ever get confused about why this movie, why a movie is so good, just go read one of Nathan's reviews on it afterwards. And that's a wrap on another episode of the Real Film Chronicles. Thank you so much for listening and hanging out with us today. We're having a great time putting these together and love sharing these episodes with you. We can be found on a few platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, and Letterboxd, all of which are linked in the show notes. You can also reach us by email, and of course, you can find our website at realfilmchronicles.com. Until next time, take care of yourselves and others, and keep that film journey going.